Hello and welcome to the Stacey's Goodbye Cocktails episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of what is an extremely bittersweet week here, Shay Slate Money. I am Felix Salmon of Axios, and the good news is that I am joined by Emily Peck of Axios.
Dun, dun, dun.
Emily, you've come on board. You're going to be writing the markets newsletter that comes out every weekday with another new hire, Matt Phillips, who's also amazing. How's it going?
Yes. Well, today was my fifth day. It's been going great so far. I've written a few things. I can put the links in the show notes, or we can wait and you can just subscribe to Axios Markets, which, as Felix said, comes out every day. And I'm co-writing it with Matt Phillips starting probably in another week. We need to do a lot of training at Axios. Felix, I don't know about that.
You have to learn how to use bullet points.
Yes. I have to learn how to be smart.
That's a skill.
But smart, yeah, it's really exciting. Emily. So I hope everyone will keep following me.
So that's the good news. The terrible news is that this is our very last week with Stacey Marie Ishmael. Stacey, what is going on?
I have a job that I have to do. And crypto is very busy and all-consuming. And I am unfortunately not going to be able to hang out with two of my favorite people and talk about the biggest markets and finance news of the day. So,
This is terrible news, and I am still kind of in denial, and I'm not happy about this, but we are going to try and squeeze you for whatever value we can this last week. We're going to talk about cocktails, because we're all going to go off and get drunk after this to drown our sorrows about Stacey leaving. We're going to talk about cocktails and whether it's a good idea for restaurants to be able to sell them to go. We are going to talk about COVID tests and how much they cost. And to kick us off, we are going to, because it's been a little while since we've had a proper newsy episode, we're going to talk about the Elizabeth Holmes verdict and what that says about Silicon Valley. We also, of course, because this is a podcast full of journalists, are going to talk about the New York Times buying The Athletic in Slate Plus. So all of that is coming up on Slate Money.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Stacey, this is your show. You get to just say what you're talking about, and we just go along. We go along with the ride. What do you want to talk about first?
I think we should do Theranos first.
Theranos first. Okay, so Theranos first. Elizabeth Holmes is going to jail. This seems almost certain, although the guilty verdict will certainly be appealed. There were 11 counts against Elizabeth Holmes, and she was convicted on merely 4 of them. Does that mean she's mostly innocent?
Well, each separate count is a 20-year max sentence, so no. But it is interesting the difference between the counts that counted and the counts that didn't count.
A lot of counting there.
One!
One! When people talk about why Theranos was worse than other startups that exaggerate, everyone would always say, because real people were involved and patients got ripped off. They got blood test results that were incorrect and all that. But when it came time for the jury to decide the verdict, the counts regarding patients getting and fraud, those were the ones she was found not guilty. And it was the investor counts.
Yeah, there was one woman who was told that she had HIV, and they were like, yeah, that was bad, but we couldn't really see beyond a reasonable doubt that that was specifically Elizabeth Holmes's fault rather than
the system.
Fault. We're not going to visit the sins of the entire company on the CEO, even though she clearly ran the company very sort of micromanagerially, if that's the word. The counts against the patients were thrown out. And then there was a hung jury. So there were three different classes of count, I guess you would say. The ones about defrauding patients, those she was found not guilty of. Then there was a second class of charges of defrauding investors. And roughly half of those she was found guilty, and half of those there was a hung jury. And this was fascinating to me, that basically the early stage investors, there was a hung jury. The jury, there were a few people in the jury, a minority, but some, who said, look, this is what early stage investors do, is they take bets on crazy risky companies. And this turns out to be a crazy risky company, and their money went to zero. And I'm not going to speak for the jurors, but I can speak for myself and say, like, on some level, those investors were, you know, fueling the company rather than being defrauded by the company. They were accomplices in some way. I'm not saying they knew that they were doing anything bad, but the much more seemingly slam dunk case against her, which she was found guilty of, was the later stage investors who poured hundreds of millions of dollars into the company based on financials and documents that they were given that were simply false. And at that point, they were like, yeah, you're just like taking poor Betsy DeVos's money and you're going to jail.
That's the thing, right? It's like, oh, Betsy DeVos is the person who gets justice in all this? That is like, it doesn't seem just.
I don't know. This is a criminal trial, right? So this isn't a trial where Betsy DeVos gets her money back.
She doesn't get her money back. But still, it just, I think what it is everyone agrees that this Theranos fraud was really bad because at the end of the day, it was patients who were ripped off. But it's harder to prove that. And the damages there are kind of smaller, even though it's life and death. Money is what counts in a case like this. So even though the reason it was bad was because of the real people involved, at the end of the day, it's like the investors, it's the counts of fraud against investors that are sort of like easier to get through. You know what I mean? The reason they were those charges, she was found guilty on those charges, is just because those are the ones that could stick.
I guess the question is, like, if she had been running a SaaS company, you know, like if she had been running a company that claimed to be making lots of money by selling software to enterprises, and it turned out she was making up those numbers, and then the whole thing implodes, and then, like, at that point, does the government even bother to go ahead with a criminal prosecution? And if they do, does a jury find that person guilty? Or do you need this human element to even get the criminal prosecution in the first place?
Exactly. That is what I'm saying. You needed the human element to get the criminal prosecution. Right, Stacey?
I think the whole point of having a jury trial is the human element, right? You're trying to argue for people being affected here. We could talk about another jury trial that involves a lot of human elements, but I think this is the one that is material.
The bigger picture, I'm curious, Stacey and Felix, what you think. The bigger picture on, like, tech companies aren't going to exaggerate, startups aren't going to exaggerate anymore, and this is a lesson. Investors will have learned a lesson from this. I feel like they're not going to learn a lesson from this.
Silicon Valley Twitter, insofar as, you know, there's any kind of consensus on Twitter, is very much taking the side of, this was never a Silicon Valley company.
Yeah. Despite the fact that if you are blocked by certain VCs, it is because you ever in your life said anything vaguely critical about either of Elizabeth Holmes or Theranos, like, come on. It's just the Stanford Mafia closed ranks around Holmes and Theranos very early on, whether it was a Silicon Valley company or not.
And there were definitely, you know, Tim Draper, and there were definitely Silicon Valley investors on the cap table. And the way that, you know, Inc. magazine put her on the cover, calling her the next Steve Jobs, I don't think they were the only person to do that. She had that black turtleneck. The whole thing quacked like a Silicon Valley, looked like a Silicon Valley. Like, she was really, you know, trying to make those comparisons as salient as she possibly could. So it was a Silicon Valley company, and it is part of the culture of Silicon Valley to be, how to put this, like,
move fast and break things.
To always be saying that you are crushing it, even when you are not crushing it. Because apparently you can never say, oh yeah, we're going through a hard time right now. That's, it's, that culture, I don't think, is going to change anytime soon, guilty verdict or no guilty verdict.
Yeah, and Matt Levine pointed this out too, and maybe other people. Like, he said, Theranos raised a lot of money from investors who didn't do too much due diligence because the world was awash in money and investors got careless. And this was before now, which you could say the same thing. The world is awash in money and investors.
When was the last time the world was not awash with money? I mean, like, it's been a while. It's been a minute.
There's a lot of money chasing investments right now. So, like, this isn't, I think that's totally right. Like, nothing has changed. Like, this changes nothing, this verdict. It was very entertaining.
I mean, in a weird way, I think that she kind of hit at exactly the wrong time. Like, right now, the world is so awash with money that she wouldn't even need to lie to raise money.
You would just
money.
Be like, right. Making it rain.
She would just be like, I'm going to change the world. I'm pre-revenue, but I'm going to change the world. And she would SPAC with a $100 billion valuation, and everyone would be like, wow, this is amazing. Now, you don't need to lie. Back then, there was slightly less money sloshing around. So if you wanted to get the divorces to you know, invest with you, you needed to lie, and then you go to prison.
And also now there's this trend, and Felix, you'll cut me off, I'm sure, if I'm saying something uninformed, but there's this trend in VC, I think it's the Tiger Capital model, where they just like move really fast with investments, like they're looking less at companies than ever before, and the money's just flowing. Like, the trend is in the opposite direction, not more due diligence, less
totally.
I don't know, like... Does the fact that Tiger moves so much faster mean that they are doing less due diligence, or does it just mean they're moving faster? They're like, they have a hedge fund metabolism rather than a VC metabolism. You know, this right? is, the VCs have this kind of multi-decade time horizon.
So they say, unless you're a media company. But I want to, exactly. I think that's such a super interesting point, because time spent does not always correlate with intelligent analysis, as it were, right? And like, I think about this in the context of job interviews. Like, it's not at all the case that being dragged through 50 hours of interviews over 4 months is necessarily going to give you a slam dunk candidate versus somebody being like, you seem great, start tomorrow. And I do wonder, in this environment where there's so much money and there's so much complexity, like, what does useful due diligence actually look like anymore?
Yeah, especially when you're talking, you know, Tiger style investments, where it's basically like, we see the product, we see the potential, we see the founder, there's no revenue here. So are we going to take a punt on this or are we not? Like, you know, certainly with later stage stuff, like we saw with Theranos, you had various of the family offices and investors who put money into Theranos saying, like, we did actually ask for more information and Elizabeth Holmes refused to give it to us. And that is them trying to do due diligence, but ultimately saying, well, I guess we want to make this investment, so we're going to make the investment even if you don't give us the information. But yeah, I think the later and the more mature the company is, you know, like, once it's post-revenue, then you probably do want to go in there and make sure those revenues are real. Get some kind of third-party accountant, something, you know?
I mean, in terms of due diligence, there was one woman, I think, who testified at the trial who was like, we didn't ask more questions because we didn't want to make Elizabeth angry at us, which just seems like, I don't do due diligence for a living. So, I mean, I kind of do, but because reporting, but that seems like bad due diligence. We don't want to ask a question because it's going
to make it also goes back to the point about the Silicon Valley. Nobody likes negativity. Right. There is a sort of fetishization of uplifting, positive support, constructive, that is the reason that Silicon Valley is so adversarial to any kind of non-frothy ink magazine. Because merely the fact of asking a question about, like, how, on what basis are you making this claim, is interpreted as a personal attack in a way that I have, when I was working there, I just found wild.
It's a very much
passive-aggressive West Coast
mentality.
Drama.
How dare you question us?
But it's also, like, to be clear about this, this is also the mentality that has driven the entire SPAC market, right? Like, no one is really able to properly diligence the companies that are going public via SPAC. The detailed accounting that you normally have to get in an S1 when a company goes public just isn't there in a SPAC most of the time. Sometimes it is, most of the time it isn't. And this kind of like, I'm just going to take a punt on a story is something that, you know, the SEC, I think Gary Gensler's come out quite explicitly and said, like, no, there shouldn't be a double standard here. That if we hold companies to a high standard when they go public via IPO, we should hold companies to the same standard if they go public via SPAC. And this SPAC loophole is, you know, especially post this Theranos verdict, like the Theranos verdict reminds us of how dangerous it is to invest in a story.
Yeah. Oh, I have one more thing I wanted to say about Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes. She has made it bad out there for women, especially
blonde women. And wear black turtlenecks?
Who want to found startups and raise money. Well, black turtlenecks or not. There was a good piece in the Times months ago, I think, where, you know, women who are trying to raise money out there in Silicon Valley are sort of tainted with the Elizabeth Holmes stink now. I think she has made it a little bit harder for women to raise money because there's an association. And also, she hit on the flip side, she's kind of destroyed the notion of the girl
boss. Well, okay,
two things.
Girl bosses destroyed the notion of the girl boss.
And
the, you know, if we go back to the reporting about what happened at Away and, you know, the luggage company and various other things like that. But I do want to comment on something. Women in Silicon Valley have always had a harder time raising money, like just as a baseline. I remember when we talked about this several episodes ago, somebody was like, is it really true? I was like, my dude, yes, it is very true that if you look at both the amount of attempted round, you know, amounts of attempted investments that folks have to make and the size of the rounds they end up raising, the profile of the investors that tend to finally put money into women, it's a whole different ball game out there. But over and above that, I don't know if the Elizabeth Holmes effect will be to be people like writing off women completely, or if they're just like, see, we told you she was an outlier anyway, we're just going to continue not investing in women, right? I don't know if there was this moment in which she flipped the narrative in the other direction in a way that suddenly made it easier for blonde, black turtleneck wearing women to raise money. And so I'm not sure that it's flipping back the other way where it's suddenly more difficult again, as opposed to just like status quo has been maintained, because she was always exceptional. Like, you don't have like a casual advisor in the form of Kissinger in terms of your average startup trying to raise money this way.
I would think it's a little worse, probably.
Worse than like Holmes at her height, or worse than pre-Holmes?
Worse than pre-Holmes. Maybe Holmes at her height made things incrementally a little bit better, and that there was more attention, like, oh, look, women can do it too, and like benefit of the doubt just for a smidge more. And now I think it's gone a smidge under where it started, if that makes any sense.
I have no faith in humanity, so I don't I don't think it
it's been terrible pretty along, says Stacey.
As you can see by the way that 2022 is going so far.
Maybe I'm wrong also, because she did have her homies come to the trial. Like, you saw those.
She
pictures.
Still has a fan base, for sure.
She has fans. Like, there are there's TikToks, of course, and Instagram posts where people are still kind of a few people. And maybe it's a joke, I don't know, are fangirling this
morning. I mean, good. You know, people need role models, and I hope eventually Silicon Valley gives them like a better range to choose from. It's just like, that's the problem with these exceptional examples.
If you're going to pick a Silicon Valley CEO as your role model, like, that's never a great place to start.
It's not an amazing pool, is what I will say from a humanity perspective.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
What's up next, Stacey?
So continuing the carnival of grimness, let's talk about rapid test pricing.
Oh, yes. This, by the way, is a global thing. I can say, as someone who's in, you know, on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean right now. Right now I'm in Ireland. Up until a few days ago, I was in England. This whole, there's this sort of meme that has been going around Twitter, which basically says, I can't believe how expensive and difficult it is to get rapid tests in America, given how in England you can get a pack of seven for free just by like pressing a button on the internet. Yeah, in theory. In practice, I can tell you, as someone who was desperately running around London trying to get a pack of seven for free, it is pretty hard even in London or even in England. But yes, in principle, you can. Whereas for reasons I do not understand, the American government, for all that it's willing to pour huge numbers of billions of dollars into trying to deal with this COVID pandemic, a broad, like everyone just test yourself all the time strategy, which seems like a really smart thing to do, has never been on the list. And on top of that, they've only approved two different tests, even though there are lots that work. And so it's incredibly hard for Americans to get tests. And they're changing hands for what, like $75, $80 for two?
Yes. They're being sold on like the secondary black market for rapid tests by people who are getting them for free and, you know, from their employers. And it's just, but the thing is, the idea that you could have ever gotten a rapid test for $14.98 or whatever the agreed number was wild to me. Like I have never seen a rapid test either in stock in Walmart for that price or available from CVS or elsewhere for anything less than $28.
I got one online for that 14.
Okay. Emily's bragging.
Okay, I have probably a horrendous take, but here I go. What if...
What's your bad take, Emily?
Okay, well, so Dr. Fauci, I think this week said it's like time to stop focusing on case counts. Like Omicron is just out there. Everyone's getting sick. It's move on from counting cases. What if it's also time to just like, if you're very sick, you go to the doctor and you get a test. And if you're not very sick, you just like, do what you do if you would get a cold or the flu. You just stay home until you feel better. Like, and don't worry about
it. But people don't stay home. People, like, every year that I have worked in the US, every flu season, it's always like somebody's like, oh, I just have the flu, hacking cough in the office.
That's real.
And people don't have paid sick leave. And, you know, and the thing with rapid tests is, even if you can get a rapid test, there are employers out there that are like, we're not going to allow you to take time off, paid or unpaid, unless you have official documentation in the form of PCR from that doctor, assuming you have a primary care doctor in the first place. So it's like, if we had the infrastructure and the kind of the cultural sensibility towards work that people would in fact stay home, that would be amazing.
Yeah, we don't. I mean, I just feel like we don't. Walmart just cut sick days. It's COVID sick day policy. They halved it. I expect other companies will soon follow suit. It's the US. We don't have paid sick leave. We have a crazy work culture, and we have something that's moving from being a pandemic to being an endemic thing.
Endemic.
So like, I don't know. I feel like, why even fight it? I don't.
So wait,
this is the worst take I've
ever
had.
Are you saying... I feel like this definitely counts as a bad take. I mean, I would put that out there. I mean, because
just like,
you know,
forget it.
Are you basically saying that we should stop having a public health mindset about COVID and no longer care about might I be infectious to others, and like just that should not be part of how we think?
I mean, the US went all in on a vaccine strategy. We have good vaccines. If you're boosted and you get this illness right now, this variant, you're probably going to be okay.
Probably, meaning like more than 50%, yes. But like given the numbers of people who are getting COVID right now, you know, even if it's 5% of boosted people having to get hospitalized, that's still a lot of people. And there are definitely boosted people who are having very, very hard times of things and going to hospital.
Yeah, maybe I'm saying like it's kind of too late to fix this testing issue. By the time like the Biden administration said they were sending out 500 million tests. I mean, by the time Omicron, I just think it's too late to do the testing way. Like the US is not going to be able to pull it off. Like just do something else.
Here's the thing though. One of the things that I have become obsessed with is the notion that Omicron is the last variant. because all of these policies, all of these, like, you can go back after 5 days, et cetera, is sort of predicated on the idea that because Omicron is quote unquote mild, which we could talk about to Felix's point, this is the policy henceforth. We don't know if we're going to get like totally Delta-esque screwed again, where the next variant that comes out is like both highly transmissible and contagious, even if you are boosted, and has really severe outcomes. And I think to your point, Emily, like the big challenge for me is the notion of endemicity, I can't pronounce that word, is being based on a current set of circumstances rather than us thinking about if actually we were looking worst case scenario at this thing, what would we have to be doing? And again, I have no faith in humanity. So, you know, I'm like, I'm prepared for whatever, but I'm also, as a person with a slew of chronic illnesses, aware that the definition of mild is really variable, right? And like we're kind of setting up, one, we don't know enough about long COVID for people who are dealing with it. And two, I, with my complete lack of an upper respiratory system, if I get a mild case of COVID, my outcomes might still be way worse than somebody else's. And to Felix's point, extrapolating that over millions is hard.
And let's not forget that there is still a really bad pandemic of the Delta variant happening in America right now. If you get COVID, you cannot be sure that you're getting Omicron. There's a lot of Delta still going around.
Maybe it was a bad take.
Yeah.
I mean, the good take is like flood the market with tests, make sure they're cheap and readily available. That's not the world we're living in right now. There is a shortage of
but
tests.
But that is the world that many people do live in. You know, the UK government is highly incompetent, but it's more or less the world that the UK lives in and various other countries. And it's an entirely possible world. And it's a world that, you know, the Biden administration has been in power for a year now. They've had a year to get up on this. People have been saying for a year, can you guys just make tests free and readily available? Couldn't you make them available in packs of seven rather than packs of two, which is like an obvious thing? Just basically make them be things that are lying around in everyone's house at all times. And they've had a year to get there, and they've managed to get basically 0% of the way there. And that seems insane to me. And that is the root cause of why we are now seeing all of this profiteering and everything else. That they're just, you know, plus a soupçon of FDA incompetence in the way that the FDA is just like, is being terrible in approving new tests. Because they're like, the test must tick a million different boxes. No, it mustn't. It has to just, you know, detect COVID. Although, you know, if I wanted to do a bad take here, my bad take would be with Omicron in particular, tests are much less useful than they have been here on two. That people are testing, people are testing negative long after they've developed symptoms, long after they've been infectious on the rapid tests. And you're like, the only utility at some, for many, many people getting COVID right now, the only utility of a rapid test is to test out. It's like, once you've had COVID, how do you know that you're no longer infectious? Well, that, if you test negative on a rapid test, that's a very good sign you're no longer infectious. But like, to test whether you're infectious or whether you have COVID, like, people have like half recovered from their symptoms by the time they finally test positive.
So can the market solve this problem? Like, remember when we couldn't find hand sanitizer and now like I can't sneeze without finding hand sanitizer? Like, there's big demand for these tests. Like, this is America. Shouldn't this happen quicker? What's the holdback?
Yeah, is it FDA? That is a good question. Why Abbott in particular hasn't been making 10, 20, 50 times as many tests as it has defeats me. I don't understand it.
Oh, I thought you would explain it.
No, Stacey will. Stacey, it's your last episode. Explain it to us.
A couple of things. One is, I remember reading a New York Times story a couple of months ago and being absolutely incensed by the reporting that Abbott had made a bunch of tests, and then because there was insufficient demand for them, they destroyed a bunch of them and laid off, you know, a slew of people who were making those tests. And then those people were like, okay, cool, we're out of a job. Abbott didn't give them any kind of reasonable severance or anything else. They went and they worked at other places. And so now they're having to like rehire a ton of people into these places in a much more competitive wage environment than had been true when they were making those decisions. And then you just have like pure production constraints, right? Which is like, even if you hire all of those people up, can you, even if you're running your people and your machines and your factories 24/7, actually get to the state of output from zero versus if we had been stockpiling over time, plus what you already mentioned about the lack of FDA approvals for alternatives. Like, I don't think you can bottleneck right. one
I mean,
company.
Like, I have to say, the tests that everyone takes when you take a test in the UK are not made in the UK. They're all made in China, right? And there's nothing wrong with the tests that are made in China. It just seems to be that the FDA has, you know, difficulties approving tests that are made in China.
So if I'm Joe Biden, I'm calling the FDA and I'm like, let's go. Let's get these Chinese tests over here.
Yeah, but if you're Joe Biden, you're also like, buy American.
Well, that's just dumb.
Is that what Bill Biden
said? That's a great Joe Biden impression.
Wow. Okay, I'm rendered speechless.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Can we talk about the fact that New York might once again have to-go cocktails? Because this is extremely relevant to my interests.
I was advised by one of the world's foremost nurses once, and I'm not even joking about this, she really is one of the world's foremost nurses, that if you do have a sore throat, then drinking brown liquor or some kind of like, you know, Manhattan or Old Fashioned or something like that is a really good idea because it opens up the capillaries and yeah, it's good for you.
Look, every Caribbean grandmother is convinced that if you are unwell, you should drink like a shot of scotch or whiskey or
maybe even
something. Rum, exactly. Hot rum, you know, splash of ginger ale. Ginger ale is also the thing that solves everything. But I have not been able to figure out, other than the, you know, classic puritanical regulate alcohol out of existence, which there are public health merits to, why don't more states embrace to-go cocktails? Like,
I mean,
what
it's
is
like,
the,
isn't,
who is
isn't
the lobbying
that like
group?
What New Orleans is based on?
That is, yeah, New
yeah.
Orleans runs on
South
to-go
Beach.
Cocktails. And I feel like, I mean, if you live somewhere where there's a lot of driving and to-go cocktails are a thing, I just feel like it's a recipe for disaster. Like, people are driving around New Orleans with like alcohol slushies and cups.
Well, most people are walking around New Orleans. But
or in Louisiana, anyway. I don't know. I'm a little...
Louisiana,
I don't
yes.
love to go
but
cocktails.
But they sell alcohol at gas stations.
Yeah, like drive-through
like
cocktails,
to-go cocktails problem.
Like feel That's like a bad idea to me.
Nuts. Yeah, it's bad.
I agree.
Really bad.
And you're not supposed to have open containers in your car, even if the container is available. So there is some nod in the direction of your breaking laws that exist. But what is the, you know, who is the group that's like, no, if you want a cocktail, you have to go into a bar.
The retailers, alcohol retailers is the people, right? It's always a fight between the restaurants and the retailers.
But a to-go cocktail is so much more expensive than making it yourself.
This is true.
As a person who spent, you know, my pandemic hobby was not sourdough baking. It was like pretentious cocktail making.
It's a good pandemic hobby, I have to admit.
I feel like, I mean, it's a good pandemic policy to have to-go cocktails so people don't sit in bars, but like more broadly pulling out, I don't know if it's such a great policy. I mean, when people are drunk, they do so many dumb things. Like, I don't think you can have a to-go
Agreed.
Cocktail policy in in an area where you have like lax gun regulations. Like that's just a cocktail okay, of death, basically. Like,
all right, Texas has a to-go alcohol policy during the pandemic, and also a little thing known as mostly the chillest gun regulations out there.
It's like, here's a margarita and a handgun.
So in the Lower East Side, we have these things now, which are axe-throwing bars, where you can like drink cocktails
please,
and throw axes.
Stop. Stop.
I'm like, no, these are two things that
guys,
should not
no.
go back. Yeah, no.
No.
But I mean, one of the reasons I've been thinking about this, and Emily, it actually relates to the idea of what's the difference between culture and legislation, is if you exist in a binge drinking culture, or you exist in a culture where like drinking and driving is normalized, or throwing freaking axes while
Felix's culture,
while drinking
apparently.
Is normalized, you know, then anything you do that makes the accessibility of alcohol easier is like net mm-hmm. negative. Right? Versus if you are somewhere where you are assuming that people are, you know, kind of outside of the range of, say, alcohol disorder, like able to make better decisions, then sure. And it's exactly the same set of policy considerations about like the legalization of marijuana and other types of drugs, where I remember when I was in high school, I was writing an essay. It was about like, what are the pros and cons of legal marijuana? And all of the people on the con side was like, everybody's suddenly going to be smoking joints all day. It's the only thing that they're going to be doing. And for perhaps a percentage of people, that might be true. But in general, greater accessibility does not always mean like widespread vice and death and destruction if the rest of your society is functioning at in a reasonably normal way.
You know what's weird is that I don't quite agree when it comes to alcohol. I think regulations around alcohol are really important and tend to save lives. Like, I guess that everyone always points to France and they're like, France is totally chill and everyone drinks wine and it's fine. But like, I think when they banned alcohol ads on TV there or something along those lines, like deaths went down. Like drinking is like people can smoke pot all day and it's probably fine. Like they're not going to kill anyone else. But like alcohol is like a public
health. Alcohol is objectively bad for you.
It's yes. a public health risk in a way that other things aren't, I think. I don't know why.
So maybe that's the public health reason to not allow to go cocktails. If they're to go, then it's that much easier to imbibe a cocktail, which, as to Stacey's point, is now hard. You either need to make it at home, which is hard, or you need to, you know, go through the whole rigmarole of ordering it and sitting down and having it served to you, and that is quite expensive if you want more than one.
And possibly fatal if you're unvaccinated.
Yeah, and so. In the pandemic, the public health risk of sitting in a bar outweighs the public health risk of, like, having to go cocktails, but only in the pandemic.
But, okay, so here's my sort of synthesis here of like, how we managed to combine the testing public health conversation, is that the reason it makes sense to do this in New York, to allow to go cocktails in New York, is precisely because New York is one of the few places in America where a majority of the population is still uncomfortable walking
Does
into
not
a
drive.
Bar and ordering a cocktail. If you're okay with walking into a bar and ordering a cocktail, then the public health calculus says that's bad. You don't want to make it too easy. But if you're in this weird COVID-y situation where most people are not okay walking into a bar and ordering a cocktail, then on some level, you know, we have a right to cocktails and we can't be expected to make them at home. And so this is the only way we're going to get our cocktails.
Yes, we have
I
a
love
right
this.
To
this is like Felix's political position is we have a right
life,
to
liberty, and what was the third
title.
One? Cocktails.
the pursuit of spirits.
That's perfect.
Fantastic.
Okay, numbers round, people. Stacey's going last, so I'll go first. 7% is the amount that the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust rose in 2021. This is this thing that has been around for many years. It was created by my good friend Barry Silbert of Grayscale.
He's good friend. We need to talk offline.
Yeah. we've had multiple Bitcoin debates over the years. But anyway, Barry started this place called Grayscale, and he basically was the very first person to create a way of being able to buy Bitcoin on the stock exchange. And it's a bit of a kludge, and you have to pay him a whopping great management fee, and no one, it doesn't make a huge amount of sense. But anyway, it's listed on the stock exchange under the ticker symbol GBTC, and you basically buy effectively an open-ended mutual fund, you know, where he holds a bunch of Bitcoin and you buy into his fund, and it's, and his fund gained 7% in 2021. It's meant to be a way to get Bitcoin exposure for people who don't trust themselves to be able to hold Bitcoin on their computer or whatever. The price of Bitcoin, contrary-wise, rose 60% in 2021. This is a massive, massive delta. And the way in which the crypto world has not been able to, you know, the law of one price, the efficient markets hypothesis, the, you know, all of this kind of stuff, even in 2021, we're so far away from that. It's bazonkers.
Why would anyone invest with this guy when I don't understand.
Such a good question.
Well, he does have how many billions under management?
It's a tremendous amount of money. He is single-handedly and through his various entities.
You can make 7% on like inflation-protected treasury bonds right now, I think.
I mean, you can make 7% on your average like crypto staking yield product. So
seems bad.
There's a lot of other ways to get that level of exposure.
Emily, what's your number?
My number is 80 million. That is the approximate number of workers in the U.S. who would fall under the Biden administration's test or vax mandate. Talking about it because the Supreme Court, as we record right now on Friday, is considering if it will uphold this mandate or not. And it's really anyone's guess. It's not, I shouldn't even say mandate, because the rule is you either employees at large companies either get vaccinated or submit to weekly testing and wear masks. And if you work at home, you don't have to do it. If you work outside, you don't have to do it. If you work alone, you don't have to do it. So, I mean, to call it a mandate, that's like that's how the Republicans like to call
things.
Well,
there's a mandate in New York, right? And Citigroup has said they're going to start firing people next week who haven't been vaccinated.
Uh-huh. And the Mayo Clinic also said it was getting rid of like 1% of its staff that aren't vaccinated yet. So, I mean, some companies and employers are doing it. Some cities and states are doing this. But yeah, there's this big federal rule that would probably move the needle for a lot of people who aren't vaccinated yet. And its fate is in the hands of essentially three Supreme Court judges.
The idea is that the sort of it goes on left-right grounds, like the most Supreme Court cases, that the liberals are like, yeah, we believe in society, and the libertarians are like, no, it's got to be an individual choice, or is that how it's going to break down?
I think so. I mean, from what the people I spoke to, the three liberals will uphold the mandates. The three the rest of the people on the Supreme Court are conservative, right-wing types. The three most, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, probably vote against the mandates for sure. Then there's this, like, they're not moderate, but like the middle people who aren't like totally right is the Chief Justice.
Amy Coney Barrett. It's all down to you.
Yeah, exactly. And who's the third? Barrett, Kavanaugh. Oh, Kavanaugh. Another. He's apparently, the fate of the vaccine mandate is in Judge Kavanaugh's hands.
I suppose the thing with the, you know, so-called vaccine mandates is if you do have large individual employers deciding they're going to do this anyway, independent of what the federal government might require, I'm fascinated when they get challenged on the basis of like, well, no, you're not allowed because it's, you know, there's no federal mandate to do that. I'm like, are you for individual rights and in states' rights and employers' rights, or are you just anti?
Right, if the federal mandate gets knocked down, where does that leave the state mandates?
It doesn't affect the state. It shouldn't affect the state mandates because the case at the court is all about federal and executive overreach. And the court has already upheld mandates at the state level. So, and what they're arguing or should be arguing, I haven't been watching because I've been talking to y'all, but they should be arguing, does OSHA, the federal agency who made this rule have the authority because, you know, they didn't get Congress to explicitly say they had the authority to do this. Even though it's in the statute authorizing OSHA, it says, like, if there is an emergency and a health risk, like, you guys can do a rule real quick.
We are truly so doomed for the next pandemic.
It's like, just so, it's just so,
or even the present one, for that matter.
I mean, I've already decided that we're doomed in this pandemic, but for future generations, good luck to you all if humanity survives.
I mean, the Biden, OSHA said when it made the rule, this could save 250,000 lives. And that was in November, pre-Omicron. I think when Delta was kind of getting like revved up. So probably could have saved a lot more lives.
Vaccines save lives, people, especially with Omicron. If you're vaccinated, it's a good way of saving your life. Stacey, what's your number?
My number is 10 million, which is the prize money that will be available to the golfers of the next U.S. Women's Open, which is like the biggest ever purse available to women golfers, because like all other athletes who compete in women's sports, they tend to be better, but still somehow paid less compared to the athletes who compete in the men's sports. So this is happening because there's a new sponsor, ProMedica Health System, who's like, yeah, no, we're just gonna pay more. We're gonna hopefully make this a more attractive purse. Golf is a sport, and I say this as the perspective of somebody who, on the island that I grew up in, if you played golf, you were 100% one of the 1% in the country, because to have access to golf courts, to have access to equipment, to fly around to tournaments, it was off limits to most people. And I know that there are folks in the US who have been long trying to change the perception of golf as like a purely elitist sport. And frankly, just having bigger purses at the open level, but all the way on down is a really helpful way to do that. Because when generally the higher prize money tends to correlate with more sponsor interest. So you are able to get better sponsors because they're like, oh, people are taking women's sports seriously now. I can take women's sports more seriously too. It's going to be easier for you to get sponsors. I always think about this at the very local context. When I was in high school, I played for my high school's football soccer team. We were terrible, but we were like, it was not a good team, but it was impossible for us to ever get sponsors. Whereas the equally average men's football team at adjacent high schools just had local businesses like throwing money and stuff at them constantly. And it was just a source of endless frustration.
Is that like high school golf teams? I know nothing about golf.
You know, that surprises me. I feel like you'd be a person who has a lot of friends who play golf. I don't know if they're high school. Yeah, no,
I have one friend who plays golf a lot, but he is definitely part of the 0.1%.
Yes, there are certain, I remember a couple of years ago looking at something golf related. It was around like when Tiger Woods was a person we talked about more regularly. And some people choose their private schools based on how good the golf team is.
They have teams.
Private schools, wow, for their children.
Mm-hmm. You see, this is great. This is why we need you on this show, Stacey, because you educate us about the most unexpected things, like private school golf teams, you know? I did not know that you were an expert in such things, but I don't know. I feel like I'm very sad because you're leaving, and it's a bad way to start off 2022. But I'm happy that you made it through at least this first episode of the year. We are going to keep you on the email alias for a little bit while everyone writes in and says, come back, Stacey, please come back. Quit your job at Bloomberg just so you can stay on Slate Money. And yeah, do that. Write in, say thanks to Stacey, who's been the best host that Slate Money has ever had. And thanks as well to Shayna Roth for producing this international show. And yeah, we will be back next week with even more Slate Money.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, This is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.